Hello and welcome to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. We're here today in the studio to talk about a topic. Some of you may be familiar with the term, others not so much, but the topic of vocation, one's calling in life, maybe a way to explain it briefly, but we'll get deeper into it than that. We're excited to have in the studio today some guests. We are without Ben, so Peter is doing his best on the technological side of things, but we do have two of my sons, Nicholas and Isaiah, who are joining us. You want to say hi quickly in the mic, gentlemen?
Hello.
Hi.
And across the hall, boycotting the podcast, are two of my daughters, Anna and Sophie. They are unattended. Who knows what they're doing? Perhaps they're on YouTube. We'll talk about that later. But most importantly, we're excited to have in the studio with us a new colleague of mine and a friend of both Peter and mine, the Reverend, I guess Reverend Doctor now, Mike Berg. Mike, why don't you briefly introduce yourself for our listeners?
Hello. Thanks for having me. My name's Mike Berg. And I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, or outside there, and I'm a diehard Cardinals fan. We just went to the game yesterday. We had bad news. The wrong team won. Then we spent some time in Los Angeles area and then in Detroit, and I served as a pastor after going through many years of school in Woodlake, Minnesota for 12 years, a wonderful place, and now I'm here in Milwaukee at WLC.
And we're happy to have him here with us. Mike especially works with some topics that I think will bring a lot of benefit to the department, and especially vocation and apologetics. And we'll get into apologetics in another episode. But we are excited then today to look at vocation, how Christians can serve as mass of God for their neighbor. And with that, we will then make our way to Nicholas with the disclaimer.
This show doesn't speak for our churches, our church bodies, or our employers. To be honest, much of the time it probably doesn't speak for us. We will be thinking out loud a lot, so approach what you hear with a healthy skepticism, because as a responsible resident of planet Earth, that's what you probably should do with generally just about everything. If you find yourself getting too worked up, tune out, look around, and realize you were just listening to a podcast. That's right, a podcast. So go live free, friends, and don't let us get in the way.
Nicholas, you sounded that out very well. I don't know what the school has been talking about when they send home those slips about a second-degree reading level. We thank you for the disclaimer. Very well done. And with that, we will make our way to the scripture narrative. And that brings us to our scripture narrative for the day. We referenced this briefly in our last episode, which should be coming out soon. We're a little bit behind schedule with families and work obligations, and I guess on Peter's part, just general laziness. But we're doing our best to catch up. And so today, just briefly looking at a familiar passage taken from St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, verses 8 to 10 in chapter 2. And some of you will know them, some might not. But for by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your doing, it is the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one may boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. And I just want to hit on the verse 10 there a little bit, and we'll get into that more in the episode, so I'll try my best not to belabor it. But the first two, verses 8 and 9, are very familiar, especially to Lutheran Christians, how we are saved, that we are saved by grace through faith, that we have been set free through faith in Christ who was crucified for us. And that last verse, sometimes we forget then what flows from verses 8 and 9 and what flows spontaneously from. Sometimes Christians can easily fall in the temptation to think, well, now I've been saved, so now I need to keep my checklist or have my progress chart, whatever the case may be, fill out my good works for the week or what I think I can do, what great thing for God, what will get me in the glossy synodical magazine or whatever the case may be, what big mountaintop moment or mission trip. And those mission trips can be great, things of that nature, but we can sometimes overlook that we need not look far for that which God would have us walk in, and I like that translation better, that we should walk in them. It's just part of our daily life, and that is the works that God has set right before us. The ones that we oftentimes take for granted, we think them too simple because maybe they come up every day, or maybe no one else finds out about them, or maybe we don't think the impact is that great. For my students, I sometimes tell them that might be listening to their roommate at the end of the day. If you can tell they've had a hard time, for a parent, it might be changing a diaper. For a sibling, it might be helping each other with their homework. For an employee, it might mean doing that task you're pretty sure someone else probably should have done, but you're going ahead and take care of it. Whatever the case may be, that these are things that have been set before us by God, where we're at in the settings or stations or situations we're in, that we might then serve Him, and not to measure them, but to simply see them as things that we are able to do by His grace, to His glory, for the good of our neighbor. And we'll let Pastor Berg, and hopefully it's okay, Mike, we call you Mike throughout the podcast, expound on that a little bit more later. But just to have in the back of our head as we go through the theme of the podcast in general, that we are now set free to get outside of ourselves, to stop looking inside of ourselves or measuring or fretting or focusing on ourselves and selfishness, but we are now turned outside of ourselves for our salvation, but then for opportunities to serve as well, as when we're not focused on ourselves, either in despair or in self-righteousness, we can then see our neighbor for what our neighbor is, which is an opportunity to serve Christ Himself, Christ tells us in the Gospels. And so with that in mind, we will make our way to the free-for-all.
And we're back with our free-for-all, where we wrestle with the pressing questions of life and try to answer them once and for all. But since I don't have anything that's pressing right now, and since Wade had a bit of a dust-up over YouTube at his house, I'll let him go ahead and introduce our free-for-all for today.
Well, I'll have to remember to post it on the Facebook page, but this all started when the kids actually went outside, which was an exciting moment. I think the sun maybe hurt their eyes for a while. But they had gotten off their electronics and they went out and they were playing and riding scooters and vandalizing things. I'm not sure what exactly they were doing. Their mother hopefully knows. But they were out front, and I went out later and I saw that some of them have been drawing on the sidewalk with chalk. I could tell what Nick had done because it was spelled very phonetically.
I did not do anything.
But someone had written on the sidewalk with their chalk art, which is always a very keen expression of one's deepest held treasures in life. I love YouTube, and it turns out it was Sophia, and so this got me thinking about the amount of time that they spend on YouTube. And so I asked Sophie, well, did you write "I love YouTube"? And she said, yeah, I do love YouTube. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. And so I think that was the next morning I had made them read a book or something before they could get on, Anna and Sophie, that is. And there was great consternation over that. But then the other day, at Fast Pitch, some of the girls were listening to some video from YouTube, and I thought, well, this sounds stupid. And so I've been asking the kids about, okay, what is this? And I went, and I don't think we need to talk about the specific YouTubers, because it will only feed what is already, I think, an unhealthy celebrity out there. But people that seem to be famous just for being in front of a camera and acting hyper and making sometimes bad music. And so I guess my question first for the boys and then for the rest of those in the room would be, it seems to me, I mean, celebrity, I think, has always been maybe something somewhat cheap and vain and passing, but that celebrity has been brought to a new low. As two people who are on YouTube a lot, what do you think it takes to be a YouTube celebrity?
Not much.
Well, what's the recipe if you were going to try to do it?
Well, it doesn't really require any talents, which is, a lot of people are comedic, which means, like, their videos are funny, and most of the time it's based off making fun of the other people that aren't funny, as in the YouTuber we were talking about the other day.
And so you were explaining a little bit last night, some of these celebrities are celebrities, you're saying, ironically, people are watching them because...
Yeah.
Do you think the celebrities realize this?
The one we were talking about, not to be rude, but he's not an intelligent person, so he just sees that he's making money off YouTube, I'm guessing, and then just thinks that he's a very funny person.
The, Ziggy, do you have any thoughts on this? You spend more time playing video games than on YouTube, if I'm remembering correctly, yeah?
I don't know.
Are you caught up in all these YouTube dynamics?
No.
They can't hear you shake your head.
I don't care.
You don't care? You have no thoughts?
No, not really.
What do you think, just in general, you would do with your day if it weren't for YouTube? And, when we were in college, we had a professor who talked to a student and kind of asked him, it's 8 a.m., what would you be doing now? It's 8:15. What would you be doing now? What would you be doing with your day if it weren't for YouTube?
It depends, because you don't really let us do a lot of stuff.
Maybe like join a gang or something, or.
Well, probably. No, because you don't even let us go outside if we don't get supervised. So it's really hard to do anything, even play basketball on the sidewalk.
I think you boys are allowed to go pretty much wherever you want.
No.
Sophie is the one that would get kidnapped. You guys ride your bikes to the park all the time, hang out with people.
No, because, like, you're always like, no. And then
that's what I'm like.
It's really sad.
This is Deep Thoughts with Nicholas Johnston. Peter, do you have any comments or questions or thoughts?
No, I was gonna ask if they were not allowed to go outside because of your fear of them joining a gang. I know you live in a rough part of the
city. I think a gang could be an opportunity for friendship, common purpose, maybe learn a little bit about economics.
some cultural lessons there.
We're on the southwest side. I don't think there's any gang that would be really, like, too dangerous over that.
Not until the Johnstons got involved.
Yeah. The Peter and Mike, I find myself, I'll admit, I find myself spending time on YouTube, and I have used YouTube in class, especially in philosophy sometimes, for good things available on there. You guys make much use of it all, or see much purpose for it, or not really?
I don't. I like you, have children that watch YouTube all the time, nonstop, and hear tidbits here and wonder... what's happened to entertainment in our world. You know, there's a good segue to vocation here because this newfound celebrity is like the old celebrity that can never be satisfied, right? And you got to have something else in life. And we kind of think freedom is to do whatever we want, however we want, whenever we want, as much as we want. And we think that'll satisfy us. But if you look at celebrities, they always want more. And they're no different than the rest of us too. And it's an act of narcissism, much like podcasts are, right?
Exactly. By the way, like,
well,
and subscribe.
Not quite as bad as podcasts, but
did Peter? I think both Ben and you, if I'm not mistaken, will use YouTube a fair amount for tech stuff.
Yeah,
like,
I was actually
going
to say I'll try to channel my inner Ben here and say, you know, well, there's a lot of stuff on YouTube that's just very helpful, and so when I have a question, I go there, and you know, oftentimes can find an answer. So it's not just entertainment. But now this is again channeling my inner Ben. But I mean, I do like the entertainment on YouTube sometimes.
Yeah, it. I think we talked about it a little bit last time. With modern comforts and I think the effort it would take to actually know everything they're doing on YouTube would take a lot of parenting work. So I kind of just suppose I have to trust them, but I just need to mandate like one documentary for every YouTuber we were talking about type video.
Well, I think it's like, just like with anything on the internet, there's good and there's bad, right? You could waste all your time being entertained, and you know, I mean, you read something like Huxley's Brave New World, and you could say, well, we don't have Soma, we have YouTube.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's a lot of, you know, I mean, a lot of value in YouTube. You know, I mean, was it Khan Academy that's, you know, taught all kinds of people math, yeah. Which I keep thinking I should maybe take that up. But
I just, I read Brave New World when, or I listened to it, audiobook on Audible, when we were going to Ohio a little while back, and it reminded me, you know, if we did have Soma, I think I would take it.
who wouldn't?
Yeah, it, you know, you read it, and clearly, like, Soma's not... He's saying it's not good, but I think in general,
it's irresistible though. It's
not. That's the thing about it.
Yeah,
I think I would be. I'm not saying I would take it because I think you should. I'm saying I just think I'd be weak enough that, like, you know, and then I
just a taste.
Yeah, yeah, and I'd probably Soma up the kids too, so they'd stop fighting. Would you guys take Soma? See, this
please
is like,
explain.
I don't know that they could read Brave. Nah, what's a good age level for Brave New World?
See, I told my middle schoolers that they should ask their parents, but that if their parents were, if they'd read it and they were okay with it. So there's just a lot of, you know.
Adult themes.
Well, yeah, and it's done well, but he really pushes the, you know, the sexual, like, relationships,
right.
You know, in order to, like, explain the hedonistic, you
but
know.
In a scientific way.
Yeah, it is. It's. Yeah, if anyone out there hasn't read it, it's you got to read it. It's wonderful.
The well, I think that at least gets a little bit. We won't get lost in YouTube, although it's easy to get lost. I think that the biggest danger with YouTube, personally, is that they suggest videos after you watch one.
Yeah.
So you go on for the one thing, and then you're like, "Ooh, this also seems, you know, interesting."
Just a taste,
and then it's 3 hours later, like a Soma nap, and. And you're dumber, and now you go around saying yeet yeet and lol XD, or whatever else it is you guys like to say.
No, I once saw a YouTube comment on a silly video. I don't know what even, I have no idea what the video was about, but I just saw the comment said, "Well, it's time to delete my YouTube history again." And I thought, well, that's good. Like I want people to see the rabbit holes that I end up going down on YouTube necessarily.
I will just. Briefly, at one point at the end of our conversation last night, I had, you know, kind of been complaining about their generation. I'm sure I sounded like an old man. And I had said, you know, we need to go to the library, get you guys some books because, you know, your generation is just frightens me. And Maggie said, your generation raised us. And so I said, no, YouTube did. So I do think whatever their faults are, I'm going to blame it on YouTube and not on...
That sounds good. We got to pass it off to someone, right?
Are yours on? Yours are probably are never on YouTube. They're probably just reading like Virgil and Xenophon and stuff like that. Or
yeah, they're. I mean, Virgil
is Aliva in her second summer school session of the.
Did she just finish
second
it?
Semester?
Yeah, she just finished it. No, we they don't do a whole lot of YouTube. I mean, I'll pull up when I start singing a song from the 80s, and then they're like, play that for me. I go to YouTube and pull it up for them. So.
Did Mike, do you guys have anything special you do in the home to keep track of what they're doing on there, or it's kind of just a trust thing?
We'll call it trust, but we all know it's laziness. We try to curb it, but it's like pushing back the ocean.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, and I like that. Maybe I'll have to use that later. I'm pushing back the ocean. Well, Nicholas and Isaiah, unless you have anything to add, we might make our way into the main topic then today. You have a yeet yeet or a low? No. All right, with that, we'll make our way into the main topic. That brings us to our main topic of the day, which is vocation, which we will be talking about with Dr. Berg, with Mike, who has done a fair amount of work on this. Vocation is a pretty foundational word when it comes to Lutheran theology, especially. It should be for Christian theology as a whole, but especially at Luther's time was foundational for Lutheran theology. I think it's kind of had a revival in use, maybe, would you say, the last decade or 20 years, Mike, or...
You know, probably Gustav Wingren, you know, he in the later part of the last century was a trailblazer, I think. at least popular wise. And then the next generation really has, and including our current time, has really written a lot and thought a lot about it. So, yeah, when you look on the shelf for vocation, you know, most of the books are going to be within the last 20 years.
Probably, I'm thinking other names, maybe Gene Veith has been big for at least bringing the term back into use and some understanding among the lady.
Absolutely, and he writes for the theologian, but also for the laity, too. He's not a layman himself, although a super smart one, of course. He's really just written so much on that. He's the expert, that's for sure.
Yeah, maybe we'll link to some of those in the show notes, so if any of our listeners are looking for that, we can put a few resources up there.
If having fresh out of the parish now, Mike and then myself out for 3 years from the parish, do you think, well, maybe we can test it in a second here. Isaiah, have you ever heard the word vocation in school or in religion class?
No.
No, and I don't think that would be uncommon for many. How did the, in the parish, how did the word tend to find its way in your teaching? And as you studied more, did it make its way into catechism or youth instruction?
It did, and I pounded it so much that by the time I left, it was in the vocabulary of my people, which was surprising to me because I didn't think they were listening, but apparently they were a little bit anyway. You know, vocation's a funny word because today if you'd say vocation, most people would think vocational school. You know, you're learning some sort of trade, and it's related to that. But in Luther's day, if you said vocation, and still around Roman Catholics today, if you heard the term vocation, you were thinking about specifically a call to church work. A vocation as a priest, a monk, a nun, something like that. And Luther understood that, and he flipped that upside down. And so in today's age, it's kind of a weird parallel that we can flip that vocation word upside down. And that's fun to do because it's not like you have to take the word sanctification and explain it to people. They know vocational, but then you give them a new twist, and they love that because it's they can grasp it, and then they all of a sudden know something new, and it's always great to know something that other people don't. And so they really love that. And of course, deeper than that, the doctrine of vocation is so practical and so simple yet so profound. Going back to the idea of the parish, my people ate it up and loved it, and it became a regular part of even my youth catechism. We would have two lessons on vocation, which is not adding something to Luther's catechism, but just adding the table of duties, really, to catechetical instruction at that age.
And I think you're exactly right on how that word is received in the Roman Catholic Church, having myself grown up in the Roman Catholic Church through 8th grade, or through, going to Catholic school through 8th grade and then being raised in the Roman Catholic Church until I was 17 or 18. You know, if the priest was coming and teaching class or if there were flyers out in the back and it talked about if it asked or he asked, have you thought about vocations, he meant holy orders or something along those lines. And so it was, and I'll admit, even coming into the Lutheran Church, it was probably more tail end of seminary when vocation started to show up more on my map and just how much of a game changer that was, what, as you noted, what Luther did with that. The word itself, if I'm not mistaken, and feel free to correct me, vocatio, the emphasis there is going to be on a calling, right, that God is calling one to do something. And even in Lutheran circles, maybe that's not always the best terminology to use because we will talk about the divine call, and so there can be confusion with the holy ministry. The German, if I'm not mistaken, is Beruf. It's a word I always tell my students. It's like a dog barking. You can just hear the calling aspect, right? Roof, roof, roof. This is, once again, an emphasis on God is setting you in a station or he's calling you to a certain work he's prepared in advance for you to do. But is there a simple way that you have found to kind of explain the basic meaning of the term, or is there a good translation of it, or is vocation just the way to go?
I like vocation because you can relate it to voice. And it's not that hard to change people's mind about what vocational means, you know, even if they think a trade school right away. I think we keeping the concept of vocation helps to separate it from the way we use call, because there's lots of calls in the Bible and lots of calls in the spiritual life. And if you mix the two, inevitably you'll mix law and gospel. If I mix the call to faith with my call to work, I'm mixing justification and sanctification. I also like the word vocation and calling, too. It assumes a caller. It's not something that I searched out in my heart and found out that I was really good at playing guitar, and so that I am deciding that I am going to be a rock star. I needed to be called by an outside source. And we can talk about later how that comes about. It's not going to be a whisper in your ear.
Darn.
If it is, it's probably your wife, so you should just listen to it anyway. But also, just along those lines, vocation assumes a caller, but it also assumes a neighbor. There's no such thing as, for instance, a calling to leadership or a calling to this, that, or the other thing that you kind of made up. A calling to be courageous, or whatever virtue you want to list. It always assumes a neighbor, because vocation's about love, and love always has an object. And that's very important, because if we go down the road of only thinking about the virtues detached from an object, then the end of my life, especially as a Christian, is the virtue itself. And I think that's a huge problem today, especially with the spiritual growth. Nothing wrong with spiritual growth. Nothing wrong with tracking your spiritual growth in a certain sense. But it becomes spiritual growth for the sake of spiritual growth, sanctification for the sake of sanctification, instead of the telos or the end being the neighbor. And so vocation assumes a caller. You are called to this, sometimes maybe even pulled, dragged, kicking and screaming, and it always has an object of love, and that would be the neighbor in this context of vocation.
And I think something you mentioned there that I guess resonated with me, and we have the terms justification, right? Justification is that for Christ's sake, God has declared you not guilty through faith, which is itself God's gift. Sanctification, that we are now set apart by God. Sanctification itself is we are perfectly holy now in Christ, right? So in the broad sense, in the narrow sense that we will then, in our daily lives, Christ will then work through us for the benefit of others. But you mentioned not sanctification for the sake of sanctification. And I think one of the dangers in that as well is what might draw me to sanctification for the sake of sanctification. In other words, to Christian service for the sake of measuring or a checklist or whatever, is I'm trying to find some comfort in that now, right? I'm trying to find some comfort for my standing with God or where I'm at by looking at my works, which is precisely to turn the whole point of the scriptures on its head. My comfort is always in Christ. And then sanctification, which is a good word and a good thing in the scriptures, becomes something that's now drawing me away from Christ. And so I think that what you emphasize here with vocation, that we're still looking outside of ourselves, we're not looking within, will be helpful. I think one term you've used, and I've heard you present on this before and greatly appreciate it, is a term that is often used when it comes to this stuff, which is that Christians or that people serve as mass of God. What do you mean by that? What do others mean by that when they use that term?
Yeah, the term mask of God, Luther used a lot in a lot of different contexts. It has to do with the hiddenness of God, that God tends to hide behind masks. And when we think of masks, think of a carnival or, you know, in Venice and whatever, 1675 or whatever, where
1676 people, maybe even.
There you go.
All right.
Hiding behind these masks, and so you aren't yourself, or there is somebody behind the mask pulling, actually doing the actions. And I think he played on that in a couple different ways. One was with vocation. but also really the hiddenness of God, that he might hide under the mask of suffering in your life. He would go so far as to say that he would hide under the mask of the devil, which is a whole nother podcast episode if you guys wanted to do that. But when it comes to vocation, it means this. God is the one that preserves the world, but he wears masks when he does it. So think about it this way. God could very well feed us by giving us manna in the morning and quail in the evening. He's done it before. But he doesn't work that way anymore, generally speaking. And yet we still eat. How does he do it now? Well, he does it through farmer, grocer, truck driver, FDA inspector, the person who prepares the meal, who serves the meal. All those things are the masks of God. Instead of just sending us quail in the evening, he uses these people, he puts them on as masks, and he does the work. And that has huge ramifications in a lot of different ways. The most important being for us that my life has value no matter what I'm doing. Even if I'm cleaning the bathroom at the local gas station, it's God's work. And he's putting on me as a mask. And that may seem like super duper law, like that would just absolutely crush me because God is depending on me. But it's actually freedom. Going back to the idea of sanctification for the sake of sanctification, not only is that bad theology when it comes to being saved by grace alone and mixing law and gospel and justification and sanctification, it's also a recipe for a prison because you're never going to get there. As we said with podcasts, you're never going to be satisfied with the adulations of the masses. You're going to need more and more and more and more and more. And you are going to, if you are trying to track your spiritual growth, you are never going to get enough adulation from God or from others. You're never going to be satisfied because the bar is set so high. But if I'm called to do a job and I've been told this is God's work and he's going to use you and he's going to use other people to get other work done in the world and it's going to be okay, you're free to actually be who you were intended to be, someone who loves other people. And what's really great about that is that you can lose yourself in your job then. Not in a bad way, but you can really hone your craft. Even if you're cleaning a bathroom, you can take pride in that and hone your craft and get lost in it. And because you are already justified, because Jesus Christ has already lived for you, died for you, prepared heaven for you, ascended for you, has baptized you, has done all this for you, What honor do you need from mankind? There is nothing that is going to rise to the level of what Jesus Christ did for you. And so who cares if you don't get the salary you deserve? Who cares if you didn't get employee of the month even though you deserved it? Your pride in your work is the job itself and not that fake praise that we seem to always desire. And so you have a fulfillment. You have pride, you have honor, and all in a good way, because you know that it has nothing to do with your standing before God, which is something we probably should talk about too, law and gospel when it comes to vocation. But go ahead.
Just one thing, and then maybe that will be the next thing we should jump into, is it is interesting to me that the differences sometimes you see in, for instance, in the German setting or in areas influenced by Lutheranism, and then maybe the English and American setting. And part of this is maybe not a function of culture necessarily so much as economics or just the way things have been organized. But even that we oftentimes, when we talk about vocational school, right, what do we tend to think of? I remember going to high school, and that was the kids who weren't going to go to college. And so they still needed to do something. And I think you see in many parts of Europe, but especially those influenced by Lutheranism, that's not a second tier. That's a needed route. We need craftsmen. We need people who can do these skilled trades. And I know this isn't the best thing to say as someone who survives by working at a college, but I think now we almost think, you know, your college degree is what gives you value to society. Now you're ready to contribute. My college degree has never helped me when my plumbing went out or the electrical or my roof is leaking or it's never built my neighbor a house or things of these nature. Even the street sweeper probably has contributed more to society, practically speaking, than I have on my commute back and forth to talk about philosophy and theology, which I think are important topics. And so it is interesting to me that so often, you know, what are we measuring these things by? Maybe what we think is the level of training that's gone into them or the salary that is received. But you use the example of cleaning bathrooms, and anyone who has ever been out and about and needed a bathroom probably appreciates few things more than finding a clean one. As someone who spends summers at baseball and softball tournaments, I can guarantee that the girls on my team, this is something that becomes a big deal, depending at the tournament you're at.
We went camping this summer with our family for the first time, and Oliva was appalled by the bathrooms, and my wife and I tried to convince her that these are actually pretty good. It's a lot worse than this. And she went to camp then for the first time this summer, and she was obsessed with how are the bathrooms going to be. And I took her, and one of the last things she told me before I left was, "Tell Mom the bathrooms are good."
And
so
a
good bathroom is something very much to be appreciated.
Yeah, and I just, you know, I interjected somewhat too because I know Ben kind of mentioned to me after in the last episode we hit on a little bit of something, and I think I went to the example of someone flipping burgers, and that's something I did for 10 years of life, so I don't mean that. But he kind of said, it's funny, you know, how sometimes pastors will go to, you know, making fries or burgers or something as an example all the time. And you know, that just got me thinking, you know, there probably is some truth to that. Why don't I go to the accountant? Well, my wife is an accountant, and so I don't want to get in trouble, I suppose. But I think, you know, Mike, you're exactly right on, that when we remember the honor and the value and the meaning to our work does not come from anything, it cannot compare to what Christ has done for us. I think it also sets us up to appreciate any occupation and every occupation under the sun that
then serves. And every person, too.
Exactly.
And every person, yeah.
And with that in mind, then maybe we can make our way into how law and gospel play in a vocation. I know you've mentioned in the past sometimes, I'll mention something and you'll add, well, it also confuses law and gospel in vocation. And that's something that's come up a couple times. And this, I don't know that that's always correct to me, but it's a helpful part of the conversation. How do these things all butt up against each other?
Sure. Maybe piggyback on something you said before we get into that. Don't think that the German automobile, historically better engineered than the American automobile, don't think that didn't have anything to do with vocation. I can't remember that. What's the old French automobile company? It starts with an R. No, it starts with an R.
Oh, not Renault, was it?
Yeah. Renault. Yeah, yeah. Renault. Founded by a Lutheran who understood vocation, treated his employees well, honored their craft, and they were one of the best automobiles and reliable automobiles for many years. But anyway, besides the point, back to law and gospel. Luther, of course, struggled with this, and this was the center of his theology when it came to vocation. And the way he kind of understood it was this: the Christian saved has the righteousness of Christ, and so the Christian no longer is in an ethical orientation towards God. And in his commentary on 1 Corinthians 7, went so far as to say, imply and even kind of say, God doesn't even care if a man leaves his wife. It's of no business of God's what this man does. If he gets married, doesn't get married, if he sends his wife away or anything like that. And then Luther leaves you hanging there for a few paragraphs.
Don't tell my wife this, if the reverse is...
and his point was this: the forgiveness is so radical and so secure in Christ that it does not matter. That man's relationship with God has nothing to do with his works at all. And so God doesn't even care about what he does or not. He's going to love him, and he's going to have him coming to heaven. Now, that can be misunderstood, obviously. But here's the backside of it.
And someone listening, I can name a few people at this point who may jump on this and accuse us of antinomianism.
But he comes back. He comes back later and says, but this man owes everything, including his whole body, to his wife. And so, just as radical as he is with that gospel, he is just as radical when it comes to the call of husband in this particular instant, and says, that man doesn't even own his own body. His wife owns that body. And he owes everything to her. And the point he's trying to make is this. You are so free. You are so free that you don't have to worry at all about your status before God. That ethical orientation that is vertical has been taken care of by Jesus Christ. There is nothing you can do. There is nothing you will ever do. And that frees you to now have an ethical orientation that is horizontal towards your neighbors, and to be who you are, which is righteous in a righteous person in Christ. Now, we can stop right there and say, but you're still under a law. If you go down that road, fine. But what Luther and Paul, I believe, is really talking about here is that you are free to be who you were intended to be. Again, we have to understand what freedom is. We think freedom is to do whatever we want, however we want, whenever we want, as often as we want. But that's not freedom. If a drug addict says, it is my freedom and it's my body to inject this whatever into my veins, we understand that that is the exact opposite of freedom, but the worst kind of prison. Now, if I'm addicted to sin, and I am, and I can prove it because I know exactly what not to say to my wife, I know exactly what's going to come of it, why do I keep on doing it? Because I'm an addict, because I want that high. Even though that high gets less and less and less, and the hangover gets longer and longer and longer and longer, why do I do this? I know I shouldn't. I know the ramifications, but I do it because I'm an addict. And so if I want to do what I want, if I see freedom as doing what I want, I got to stop myself and say, maybe I'm the addict here, and this isn't freedom, but rather true freedom is living in this wonderful world where God gave me a wife and children and students and neighbors, and to serve them. My sinful self is still going to battle. I understand that. But what a wonderful thing to do, to be a loving human being in this world concerned about my neighbors. And maybe that's true freedom, is to be who God intended me to be and not the jerk I am.
Well, and isn't that, you know, you think of, and we have a Winging It on it, I think it's out now, On the Bondage of the Will, that came out a while ago. Luther's work that we talk about in An Uncompromising Gospel. But, you know, that's so much of Luther's theology reflecting that we're born, our will is bound, right? So freedom is to be freed from the will, which is, you know, Romans 7 comes into play, and then Romans 8 builds upon this as well, by the way, as it talks about the Spirit now, right, working in the new man. But that even Paul can say, wretched man that I am. And what happens so often when we do return to the fallen will, as you've mentioned, I like that the hangover, the high gets less and the hangover gets longer.
Well, I thought about our conversation in the free-for-all about the soma, right? I mean, that was the big attraction of the soma, is that you don't have the hangover, you know?
Yeah, and what's I can't remember John is the savage, his mother, you know, that was the big problem with the alcohol on the reservation, was the hangover and the effects it had.
That's right.
And then it took more. I think, you know, Mike, you hit so well on the man is free, right, in relationship to his wife, but then is also then now, in a sense, bound in the best possible way. You know, Luther early, and I sometimes, you know, people early Luther, late Luther, and that really, I guess, I'm just turns me off more and more now, because I think so much of the late Luther is just there in the early Luther, and he expounds more of it later. But already in The Freedom of the Christian, 1520, you know, Luther says, a Christian is a perfectly free lord of all, subject to none, not even the wife, right? Mm-hmm. But a Christian is a perfectly dutiful servant, subject to all. And I think a lot of people can read, you know, two sentences like that and not get what he's after. And I think you really kind of open that up well for us. So we're free to serve, and that really is an emphasis of the podcast.
Well, and that's the true freedom, right? I mean, like, that's kind of the radical nature of the gospel, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely, that now, well, and I think this goes back, and you can correct me, Mike, if I'm wrong, that, you know, virtue itself is not the telos, that it's not ethics for the sake of ethics, and, you know, and that's where there's not a lot of, there's some good books on Lutheran ethics, but there's not a lot that I think lay level that's really accessible, but the idea that we don't, this is not something we have for the sake of something, and I know Stephen Paulson in a book I like, Lutheran Theology, emphasizes in there that, you know, grace comes and it turns virtue on its head, or the natural orientation of human religion on its head, so that now I'm not, my telos is not, I'm going to be, you know, this many points or this many, this quality of person, but I'm just completely set free from that mode of thinking to serve. Would that be a correct way of?
Absolutely, and I think there's a, you know, make it kind of practical for people in two ways. One would be perhaps in the family sphere, that we can we're always talking about balancing. You know, I got to balance my work and my family, got to balance, throw in church there, throw in volunteering, throw in all this kind of stuff, and I got to find balance. And I'm guessing the more you talk about balance and the more you try to figure this out, you put yourself into another law here. And you got your pie chart of how much time you spend on this and how much you spend on that, where love actually can be kind of freeing for that, where the answer is almost always given to you. Who is the neighbor that needs me most? So if I'm a father and I'm trying to balance work and my children, I can be under the burden of guilt where I'm not doing enough at my work, I'm not doing enough at the family and stuff like that, where if I ask myself the question, who needs me the most right now, that's actually kind of freeing, because I was going to do the work anyway. Either right. I'm going to be here or I'm going to be there, but I don't have that added guilt anymore. Now, the devil still tries to get into my head about that, but that's the freedom that we're kind of talking about here. Like, I don't need to show up to work so that everybody sees me there, or I don't need to be at every little league game so that I'm seen as the whatever. The object, the telos of my actions is my children or my neighbors in my job or whatever, not what people think of me. Sanctification for the sake of sanctification, virtue for the sake of virtue. How freeing that is. Another example, too, in the workplace, I think, is that when you start thinking about your job in the terms of vocation, calling, my neighbor, that you really can lose yourself in your job, like we said before, and you can really hone your craft for the sake of the craft and for the neighbor, and not worry about the office politics, and not worried about all the other kind of stuff. And in our modern American workplace right now, that I think that is a kind of a problem. We talk about leadership, we talk about all these kinds of stuff, and it just strikes me as kind of a manipulation of emotions often, where instead, if you're a, I wish we could take the blue-collar mentality and put it into white-collar jobs, where the guy on the crew who does brickwork, he knows if he's doing a good job or not because his bricks are straighter than not. Now, he's got to be a part of a team, and there's got to be teamwork and all those kinds of things. But he knows if he did a good job or not, and he can lose himself in his craft, where the person, the middle manager, has a tough time doing that. And it's not to say that that's not important or you can't get there, but boy, there's some real freedom there when you're focused on the craft itself for neighbor and not the office politics, all the other things that kind of take up the day in, I think, a lot of middle-class American homes and their workplaces.
And I think hopefully this is something we can get some wing in it sessions out of sometimes.
I was just thinking the same thing.
When,
it seems like there's a lot
of maybe Peter's around, or if I catch Dr. Berg in his office. But I hope this is, and I think there's another episode in this too, I think I'm listening to Mike and feeling a little freer, so hopefully everybody else is feeling that way too.
That's because Wade doesn't show up at the office very often.
His office is next to mine, so he knows. I do think, you know, this will be episode 20. Is that right, Peter?
Yeah, I think that's right.
So I think it's taken us about 20 episodes to get there, but I think this is an episode that's really encapsulating a lot of what Peter and Ben and I want the podcast to be about. You know, we mentioned in the first podcast kind of the idea of where we got the living freely in a world given back to us. One of it was from a Luther hymn verse, but also Gerhard Fierdy, boogeyman of the confessional Lutheran world, has written in a more radical gospel, but after all, in spite of our reluctance and timidity, it isn't some Herculean task we are being asked to do. It has all been done. All we have to do is say it. Just let the bird fly. And I think that's what Dr. Berg has really encapsulated for us well today, is that when we balance law and gospel, justification, sanctification, all of these doctrines that meet in vocation, that we are set free to then live in a world that has been given back. It is gifted back to us now for us to rejoice in God's gifts and to see in our neighbor also a gift of God to serve, to find in our daily tasks means for glorifying God, and to know we do so as one who is saved, as one who is justified, and not to be justified, to live the baptismal life. And I think we could go on for this for another hour, but I know Peter's going to have to run soon, and I'll be honest, I don't want to have to do the work at the back end that I'd otherwise have to do if he goes. But hopefully, Dr. Berg, you'd be willing maybe to come back on sometime or to join us for some Winging It?
Absolutely, and I think there's a lot more to say about vocation, so episode 40 or whatever whatever that the rotation is, you let me back.
We won't have to wait that long. We let Bordeland come on twice already. So I think we'll balance that out. We talked about balance. But as we then come to the end, and we didn't warn you, Dr. Berg, about what you're supposed to say now at the end, and I don't know that you've listened yet, so I'm going to give you a hint. You're going to say, let the bird fly, okay? So when it comes down to it,
see,
when we
Dr.
look
Brown's
at the different...
Dr. Brown's going to listen to this, he's going to say, come on, that's not fair.
Yeah, because we didn't help him, and yeah. He messed up. But whatever our job might be, and sometimes, you know, especially now at the college, you're working with students who feel like they're in between, right? Or they're getting ready for a vocation or job. And so even when we find ourselves, and it seems that our station where we've been put isn't all that certain or sure, what's the only thing we can ultimately do?
Let the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to clown. I don't care what the people are thinking. I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set 'em up another round. I set 'em up another round, I'll set 'em up another round. One more round won't get me down.